Case number 15-1118 et al. Emera Maine, formerly known as Bangor Hydro Electric Company et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Raskin for petitioners, Emera Maine Utilities. Mr. Promper for petitioners, Attorney General of Massachusetts Customers. And Ms. Pixella for the respondent.
Good morning. My name is David Raskin. I'm representing the New England transmission owners who are petitioners. We raised two issues before the court. On the first issue, this case involves the commission's decision to change an existing rate under Section 206 of the Federal Power Act without first finding that the existing rate was outside the zone of reasonableness under the statute. Two cases in this circuit hold directly to the contrary. They are Papago Utility Authority v. FERC and City of Winfield v. FERC. In both of those cases involving different factual circumstances, the court held that the commission must first find that the rate is entirely outside the zone of reasonableness before it can act under Section 206. The commission does not ask this court to overturn either Papago or Winfield. Neither case is cited in the commission's brief. They are asking you to disregard those holdings. We urge you not to because they are the law. There is a third principle that the commission's decision violates based on longstanding law, and that is that Section 206 of the Federal Power Act requires a two-step process. First, the commission must find that the existing rate is unjust and unreasonable, and then and only then can it proceed to the second stage and determine a single new just and reasonable rate. If the finding that a single rate is just and reasonable satisfies both prongs, there is no longer a two-step analysis under Section 206, in this case and in any other case. And therefore, the commission needed to come to this court and explain why this court should overrule longstanding precedent in faith that supports the fact that a two-step analysis is required.
You know, we can't overrule precedent. You understand that?
Yes, so, I do.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and in Papago, my reading of Papago is that they essentially did the two findings at the same time through the same study and rejected this argument that you have to sort of formalistically march through one rather than the other since you're going to do the same survey and then produce the information.
That is not my reading of Papago, Your Honor. In Papago, the utility had waived its right to make a Section 205 filing, and therefore the rate could only be changed pursuant to Section 206. Mm-hmm. Because that was the case, the court needed to search the record carefully and determine whether the existing rate was entirely outside the zone of reasonableness before it could be changed by the utility under Section 206.
They didn't make that, right? The commission, I'm reading from 956, the commission did not make such a finding because it thought it was going under, right, 205.
The commission,
so.
That's correct. The factual circumstances are unusual.
No, but then the reality is that you didn't have this sort of, we may have other challenges to whether they made a reasoned determination of unjust and unreasonable.
Your Honor,
this ordering thing just isn't
unusual
at all.
I understand that it's unusual for the court to make a finding that the commission did not, but in the second half of the decision, the court searched the facts in great detail and determined that because the existing rate afforded a return on equity that was so low, I believe it was slightly above zero, that the existing rate was entirely outside the zone of reasonableness, and therefore it could be changed under Section 206. In addition, the court held that because the commission had found one ROE to be just and reasonable, other ROEs within the zone of reasonable were not necessarily unjust and unreasonable, and it therefore contradicted one of the commission's central tenets in this case. Later in Winfield, the court held that Section 206 provides a zone of protection for utilities. The court specifically recognized the importance of rate stability under the Federal Power Act. The electric power industry is the most capital intensive in the country. Utilities spend billions of dollars in investments on new facilities. And if the rates are subject to a hair trigger change without a finding that they're outside the zone, you are undermining the need to raise investment capital on a consistent basis. And in fact, as a result of the commission's holding in this case, we now have four complaints pending against New England transmission owners, which will probably leave their ROE up in the air for a decade or more.
Can I ask you about your argument that your rate was not unjust and unreasonable because it was within the new DCF zone?
That's correct.
Do you believe that any rate anywhere within that zone that the new DCF calculated was necessarily just and reasonable?
Not unjust and unreasonable. Section 206 requires a threshold finding that the existing rate is not unjust and unreasonable. Mm-hmm. And the cases hold that if the existing rate is within the zone of reasonableness, it is not unjust and unreasonable for purposes of that threshold determination under Section 206.
And your position is that not unjust and unreasonable is not the same as just and reasonable? Got a double negative there, which
yes,
normally means
is.
The same.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I followed what you said. It sounded to me like you misspoke or I misheard. Your position is that 206 requires first a finding that it is unjust and unreasonable.
That's correct. That's
and
what
I thought
meant
I
to
heard
say.
You say it's not unjust.
I'm sorry, I meant to say
you
it is unjust.
I may have misheard.
Well, I gave away my case, and I apologize. I would like it back.
Okay.
So it's semantics, I guess, but and I can't disagree there's a double negative there.
I really would like an answer to the question whether, once a DCF is calculated, every rate within that zone is just and reasonable, in
yes,
your view?
For purposes of the threshold analysis under Section 206.
Is there a different just and reasonable for that there is for, it's the same language throughout the statute.
Well, it is the same language,
meaning.
But Section 205 does not require a two-step process.
Mm-hmm.
So how the zone of reasonableness is incorporated.
I'm asking you whether it's just and reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor,
does that mean the same thing in every aspect of 206, both the first step and the second step?
No, just the first step. We agree that in the second step, mm-hmm. the commission has to determine a specific rate, and once it's determined that the existing rate is outside the zone of reasonableness, it has the discretion.
But nothing within the zone of reasonableness, do they have discretion to decide that anything within the zone of reasonableness is not unjust and unreasonable?
No, they do not.
Wow.
Is that...
I thought Blue... Go ahead.
Is that absoluteness necessary to your case? You made the absolute statement just then that anything within the zone of reasonableness, the commission cannot properly find that it's unjust and unreasonable. Am I correct in what you're asserting?
For purposes of the threshold analysis.
For purposes of the first analysis.
I think that in the second step, the statute requires FERC to set a particular rate. It is a practical necessity that in setting a particular rate in the second step, they've got to pick a particular rate within the zone of reasonableness, and that's what they do, and we don't argue that that's incorrect, and that they have to pick the rate at the high end of the zone. We have never argued that.
Now, they say the statute says you just have to charge a just and reasonable rate,
yeah.
Correct?
That's correct.
So you could pick any rate within that zone, including even a higher one than the commission picks, and you would be consistent with the statute because you would be just charging a just and reasonable rate.
Well, under Section 206, we don't get to pick a rate. Section 206.
I'm asking whether you violate the statute by charging a rate that's within the zone of reasonableness.
We do not violate the statute. And the commission's decisions.
So even if you pick one, the commission has said, we think it should be. Imagine they picked the midpoint here, and you said, thank you very much. We see that our 11.4 is within the zone of reasonableness. We're sticking with that.
That is not our position, Your Honor.
But why isn't it your position? It would be just and reasonable.
Because we believe there is a difference between what the commission has to find in the first step of the Section 206 analysis and what the commission must find in the second step.
There would be a range of rates that could be found to be just and reasonable.
And then
the commission has to first find that the rate is not within that range of rates that's just and reasonable. Forget about the term of art about the zone.
That's correct.
So it's a different finding.
It is a different finding. And if it were not a different finding,
Section 205, then the commission could go straight to the step of finding a just and reasonable rate.
Well, it can.
But since it's a 206, the commission has to go through this first step first under Papago and the other case.
That's correct. That is our position.
Okay.
And we don't challenge the fact that the commission has to and is statutorily directed to find one single rate within the zone of reasonableness in the second step. If it couldn't do that, then it couldn't satisfy its responsibilities.
Is it sufficient for them to say that, look, market conditions have changed materially since the original rate was set? It was just and reasonable when set. The world has changed materially. We cannot rely on the process that produced that number. We need to do a new calculation. Would that satisfy the first step?
Only if the DCF analysis showed that things actually had changed materially and the existing ROE was outside the zone of reasonableness.
No, I want to be crystal clear here, and I want to make sure we're very specific about the language we're using. So they say the market conditions have changed materially.
Right.
We can no longer trust the process that produced that number that was just and reasonable at the time is still being just and reasonable today. So we are going to calculate a new DCF zone. I'm not going to call it a zone of reasonableness. We're going to call it a DCF zone. And on the basis of that calculation, determine that the old rate is unjust and reasonable and a new rate should be charged. Can they do that?
Well, no, because the DCF zone is the zone of reasonableness. The commission has called it that, the statutory zone of reasonableness. And this is really...
The zone of reasonableness is not a statutory term, though. The statute doesn't require a zone of reasonableness.
No, but the case law, is just rampant.
So it would be possible for the commission to render a decision, just as the presiding judge describes, that doesn't use the term zone of reasonableness, but could still find that the rate was unjust and unreasonable. Is that not the case? Or?
No, that's not the case.
Why not?
Papago and Winfield hold that a rate has to be entirely outside the zone of reasonableness. That is the law.
So you would say the semantic of zone of reasonableness controls over the substance of a decision that said this rate is unjust and unreasonable because, and then went through an explanation.
So my argument is that what is unjust and unreasonable is not picked out of the air. What the DCF does is requires the commission to do its math. So if the commission believes that circumstances have changed and the rate maybe ought to be changed, the DCF and the zone of reasonableness tells whether or not that change is significant enough, material enough, to warrant making a change under Section 206 and overriding the Papago and Winfield.
I'm still not at all certain that I understand why the commission would have to use the term zone of reasonableness if it did an explanation of why the rate was unjust and unreasonable. I'm not asking you to say that they did such an analysis here, but if they did, would it be invalid simply for not using the term zone of reasonableness?
I think it would, Your Honor. I'm not sure that's necessary to the holding in this court, but in this case, but I believe that that is part of the case law under the statute, that the zone of reasonableness is a critical concept, and it needs to be respected in setting rates under Section 206. But in this case, they didn't find any zone. They found that a particular rate, only one point, was just and reasonable. Thank you.
Well, actually, I wanted to, you have a couple other arguments, and it's fine, you can go on with your time. Do you, you had this argument about notice about your incentive adders.
Yes.
What more, given that the commission's rule that the DCF zone, the top of that, caps the ultimate rate, so the ROE plus the incentive adders can't go over the top. That was well established. I don't understand you to be challenging that rule in this case. So given that you knew that rule was there, they told you it was there and would be enforced in this case, what more would you have argued if they had given you the notice you say you were entitled to challenge the effect of the cap on your incentive adder?
Well, when the commission sets the cap on an incentive, it's only looking at one particular project. So at the time it establishes the incentive ROE, it looks at that project and determines whether or not the incentive puts the ROE above the high end at the time the incentive is established. That does not mean that later, when it has a 206 proceeding, that that incentive is subject to reconsideration when it becomes part of a rolled-in rate in which the overall ROE is not above the zone of reasonableness. And I would argue, Your Honor, that if the commission continues to interpret the law that way, they're undermining the purpose of Section 219.
So that sounds like a different argument. That was your argument about the specific project, no finding of the invalidity of the specific project. I'm asking about your notice argument, which was a procedural argument, that you weren't given notice.
That's correct.
That your incentive adders might
That's
be
correct.
Clipped off in this process. And what I'm asking you is not about that argument, which I struck as a different issue raised. But had you gotten the notice that you say you should have gotten about the potential impact on incentive adders, what would you have argued that you didn't already argue?
We would have argued that Section 19 was enacted by Congress because there had been for several decades inadequate investment in new transmission facilities in this country. And Congress determined that incentives needed to be provided to get transmission utilities to build new transmission assets. The average age of our transmission grid is over 40 years today, and the New England TOs are in the middle of modernizing the one in New England. If the commission is going to grant an incentive, that's saying to investors, you are going to make more money, so come in and give us your money and invest in the transmission grid. If the commission turns around a year later and says, whoops, you're no longer above the high end, some or all of that incentive is gone, to someone who's made an investment in a long-lived assets, that's closer to bait and switch than an incentive.
I thought you had made that argument to the commission on rehearing. Is that incorrect?
We may have, yes.
Okay, so then even if there was a notice violation, it was harmless because you made the argument to the commission. You haven't told me yet what argument you would have made if given more notice that you didn't get to make.
Well, I think the commission didn't address the argument on the merits. Mm-hmm. The commission simply found that it had been their earlier holding that it's capped at the high end. So the commission never analyzed whether or not what they're doing is consistent with the policy under Section 219.
Right, and that's a different argument than a notice, and then that's just a lack of sufficient reasoning argument.
I guess so. I think that's fair.
Okay. All right. Can you explain to me how it is, I take it your position is that you certainly don't disagree, at least with the commission's decision. Now in step two, they didn't do step one, but once we're in step two,
right,
they did the DCF zone, looked at the midpoint and said we can't rely on that.
Right.
And this time the DCF calculation can't be relied on to incorporate these anomalous economic conditions.
Right. And in light of the fact that all of the other models that the commission used showed a higher ROE.
That was part of the evidence as to why they couldn't rely on the DCF calculation
yes,
like they
right.
normally would.
That's right.
So why is it reason to rely on the top part of the DCF calculation to get you a rate? If the DCF calculation is flawed, because it's not incorporating information it needs to incorporate, what on earth makes the top quarter any less flawed?
I think the commission recognizes that you can't determine what the actual equity cost of capital is The entire exercise is to attempt to infer something that you can't get from the marketplace itself. Unlike a bond yield, for example, of 7%, the cost of equity is not known. And so the commission uses tools to try and estimate that cost of equity. And the primary tool it uses is the DCF. Mm-hmm. At some point, the realities of the world have to coincide with the regulatory process. Mm-hmm. So the commission does the best it can in stage two to find a single ROE that is just and reasonable.
But if everyone agreed, the commission
agreed,
the DCF just didn't work this time the way it normally does.
And that's why they...
So why would it work? Why should we trust the top quarter if we aren't trusting... Why should we trust that midpoint rather than the other midpoint? What reasoned explanation is there for thinking that was the right way to fix the problem?
Because the ROE that they set at the high end of the mid-quarter was comparable to the model results from the
CAPM. No, it was not at all. No, the four methodologies they used all came in way lower than that.
Oh, that's not true.
I think every one of them came in lower than the rate you got. Do you dispute that fact?
No, I do dispute that fact, yes, Your Honor, for sure.
Okay. All four of them came in with the number?
Maybe my memory's not that good. It might have been three out of the four. But clearly, the others were showing that the midpoint was too low.
They showed the midpoint too low. But I didn't read any of them as saying the top quarter midpoint. The top midpoint was where it should be. They were all under that, as I read the record. If you read the record differently, that would be very much helpful to know
I
that.
I do. I recall, and I'm going by memory, please. Okay. But my recollection is...
If you can let us know when you get up on rebuttal which numbers were...
Yes.
On both sides of the number you finally got, that
certainly,
top quarter,
certainly.
So that was actually a midpoint.
Can I make another point about the number we finally got? The commission changed methodologies in this case at the decisional level. While it may look like they went out of their way to give us more, if you apply their old methodology, which had a much higher high end of the zone of reasonableness, you will see that the result is not very different from what we would have gotten if they had not changed
that. You didn't challenge that before the commission.
We did not, for that very reason.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. David Pomper for customers. For decades, FERC was married to a single way of setting base returns, the discounted cash flow method, DCF. As to increases, FERC faithfully followed the DCF up. We're here because for no clear reason, FERC refused to follow the DCF down. It thereby violated the fundamental teaching of Hope Natural Gas that returns should follow the market cost of capital as it rises and as it falls. DCF was FERC's way of quantifying that principle. The reason FERC relies on DCF is that it infers the cost of capital at any point in time from utility stock prices, which embody all information known to investors as to what capital costs at any point in time. And this complaint was brought to ask whether the cost of capital had declined since FERC relied on DCF to set the New England return a decade ago. To answer that question, FERC ran its own DCF analysis, at least to start answering it. And they analyzed 41 comparable risk utility stocks, discarded the lowest three results, and were left with an array of 38 DCF data points, clustered mainly around nine. But then FERC locked off the 21 lowest results, leaving it with a truncated distribution of only the 17 highest results, and it set the return above all but three of those. So FERC hacked its DCF analysis into pieces and buried most of them, the parts most useful to customers. Now FERC tried to smooth over that burial by saying that, well, market conditions are anomalous in some ill-defined way, and by saying that customers had agreed market conditions were anomalous, which we had not. They speculated that anomaly somehow distorted the DCF result. They didn't explain the cause. And so they cited the low interest rates, but they didn't explain how those affected the analysis. So their analysis here is even more opaque than in Tennessee Gas.
Can you explain to me how the DCF would have incorporated the already low, the super low, historically low Treasury bond rates?
The DCF is based on dividend yields, which are consist of the dividends the stocks actually paid divided by the actual market stock price, mm-hmm. and growth estimates.
Mm-hmm.
The stock prices incorporate efficiently all relevant information. That's what Tennessee Gas is really all about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the interest rates known to investors, expected by investors, factor into the prices.
Mm-hmm.
And they factor into them in good times and bad.
Was the commission relying on the DCF and other cases around the same time without departing from it, even though the market conditions would have been exactly the same?
Yes, Your Honor, and exclusively so. Mm-hmm. FERC has relied only on DCF for decades. It relied on it during the turbulent market period following September 11, 2001. That was the Public Service mm-hmm. of Kentucky case.
Mm-hmm.
It continued relying on it on cases before, during, and after the 2008 financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
In the Pacific Gas and Electric case, months before this case went to hearing, FERC relied exclusively on DCF summarily, and summarily directed the utility to use the median of a DCF range distribution.
Well, you say it was right
determined.
Before this hearing, but was it covering the same time period?
That one was covering a period a couple years before, and then in the Seaway case decided after this one, that relied on a study period that overlapped the one here. Three of the 6 months were in common. And in fact, the months Seaway involved a slightly earlier period with slightly lower interest rates. And FERC again relied on the DCF without adjustment. And FERC, of course, also relied on the DCF here to set the incentive cap. And FERC has never explained why DCF was reliable for that purpose, but not for purposes of setting the actual base return.
Well, I thought you would argue that it wasn't reliable for using the top quarter midpoint rather than the normal midpoint. Because what they said the normal midpoint isn't going to work, so we're going to take the top half, divide that in half, and use that as that midpoint. We're going to use the top half midpoint, quarter. I don't know how else to describe the top quarter midpoint. On what basis did they have to think that was reliable?
Well, it's not clear, other than saying that DCF continues to work for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now FERC turned to four other methods that it had previously spurned to tell it to set the return above the midpoint. It had previously rejected each of those methods for reasons, many of which continued to apply, and they never explained why they were more reliable now than they were then. But the only thing that FERC says it took from those methods was that the return should be set someplace above the middle. It didn't look to see how far above they pointed. And in fact, if you go through them one by one and you look at them critically following the logic that FERC applied in its decisions, none of them point unequivocally above the top quarter. They all, as a collectivity, point below the top quarter. And it may be useful to go through them one at a time. Mm-hmm. The state cases were really the most important thing FERC looked at. And there's no dispute. Over the two-year period that FERC looked at, they were generally in the low 10s, well below 10.5, and by the most recent information in the record, they were averaging 9.75, so well below the 10.57 that FERC set. Capital asset pricing model, FERC plainly relied on the median there because it gave two different numbers for the midpoint. It gave two different numbers for the median. And the midpoint was 10.4, so again, below 10.57. And it would have been even lower had FERC applied the second stage GDP growth constraint that paragraph 113 of opinion 531B demands, logically. The risk premium produced a number slightly above 10.57, but it did so based on a math error we've explained on brief, and FERC has not had any counter to. And that, with a math error corrected, it points no higher than 10.22, and there are other errors which would drive it even lower. Expected earnings, the median of that distribution was 10.2. And FERC says on brief, well, if any of these are above, then that's enough, that's a sufficient reason you can affirm on any independent ground. That's not what the first opinions say. First opinions say they're all above, and it's not clear what they would have done had they realized that the CAPM, for example, points below the midpoint. So an explanation really is sorely needed as to why the DCF wasn't working here, and FERC hasn't given it. I would also point to footnote 306 of opinion 531. That framed the rules for subsequent cases, including the next New England complaint, which it set for hearing the same day. And it said that we will consider every point in the DCF range. So how did FERC exclude all the options between the midpoint and the upper midpoint? Mm-hmm. It did so based on a formalistic rule that in regional cases we only do midpoints. Yet at the same time it said we don't only do midpoints. In Kentucky, it did do the midpoint of the full range, not the midpoint of half the range. And the reason it did that was because the endpoints of the full range emphasized the cost of the region's highest and lowest cost utilities. That logic does not carry forward as a basis for using the top quarter, because the lower cost utilities in the region, represented by the 21 data points that FERC buried, are relevant to determining what well fits the region. FERC simply ignored that. Kentucky also says not to use the midpoint if the distribution is highly skewed, and it adopted a test for skew based on the jumps between adjacent points. Applying that same test here to FERC's truncated 17-point distribution, it is highly skewed, so the midpoint doesn't follow from that either. And then in other cases, FERC had not used the midpoint, the upper midpoint in any comparable circumstance. It had set returns all over the range, including in the prior New England case, including in the cases cited in Judge Santel's Arrow decision last year. There's been no rule that we only do midpoints, and the only two cases FERC cites as having done midpoints did so because there was no other information in the record pointing to any other point in the range. So they're left with this formalistic rule. They sort of pantomime empiricism, but the decision is not empirical. It's based on this formalism that, well, we do midpoints, except maybe next time we won't, and we don't always. So it doesn't really hang together. There may be some basis on which FERC can rationalize this result, but they haven't done so yet. The court should remand for more explanation.
So the remedy you would seek is for us to set aside FERC's decision and remand it for further proceedings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I'm happy to answer any further questions. Otherwise, I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pasella for FERC. I think I'll start with the customer issues first, since that's where we ended. Let me first start talking about why the Commission chose 10.57 as the just and reasonable.
Can I actually? I'm sorry.
Of course.
Just to back up, I worry some in this case that people aren't using the same language for the same meaning, or I'm misunderstanding the language,
sure.
And it's probably more likely the latter. When you talk about the DCF zone, and you talk about a zone of reasonableness, are those necessarily the same thing?
The Commission uses the term zone of reasonableness in the DCF analysis. What that is a zone of reasonable returns for proxy company utilities. So it's an industry zone of reasonableness. The Commission determines the particular just and reasonable return on equity, base return on equity for the particular utility or utilities at issue before it by looking at that zone as a broad zone, not as a zone of reasonableness that we use for other, like cost of service rate, the rate itself, but the
component. My understanding of the zone of reasonableness.
It then takes that and looks at the circumstances related to the particular utility or utilities before it and determines within that zone of reasonable returns, industry returns, what the just and reasonable zone is for the particular utilities.
So when the Supreme Court talks about zone of reasonableness or some of our prior cases, I had read that as more just recognizing that the relevant factors will not commonly dictate a single number for FERC to pick, and that, in fact, it's not that an entire calculated zone, the bell curve, whatever it ends up looking like, are all reasonable, but simply that there is room for judgment within by the Commission.
Certainly. That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
In the process of doing that, Do you dispute the proposition advanced by petitioner that under a 206 analysis, the commission must first find the existing rate to be unjust and unreasonable, unjust or unreasonable or both, before moving to the definitive step of determining a new rate that is just and reasonable?
I think in most circumstances, Your Honor, that is how it works, that it is a one-step, two-step. But in this circumstance, with the return on equity component of the rate of service, that is done in one step.
I don't understand why that would not be required, or I don't understand if the commission explained why that would not be required any 206 analysis as opposed to a 205.
I think that if you look at, which we cited in our brief, Public Service Company of New York, 642 F. 2nd, 1335, at 1350 note 27, there the court said, that case shows that collapsing in the ROE context, the two steps of 206 into one is okay.
Did the commission say that in this case?
Did the commission say that? I'm sorry?
Did the commission say that in this case?
Yeah, sure. That's what the commission, what the court said there was the commission's conclusion that only rates between 13.5.
In the case before us, did the commission say why it was pretermitting the first step of the 206 analysis?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know what you mean by pretermitting, but the commission did it. What the commission said, yes, at opinion 531B at JA 116 to 17, paragraphs 32 to 33, the commission said because the commission finds only a single base return on equity just and reasonable, showing that the return on equity methodology now produces a numerical value below the existing numerical value inherently establishes that.
I'm sorry, which paragraph are you reading from?
I'm paraphrasing what the paragraph, but it's at 530.
We would rather you would tell us what the commission said.
Yeah, sure.
Because we have to decide based on that,
sure.
Not on post hoc justifications.
No, it's in 531B, JA 116 to 17, paragraphs 32 to 33. And it's as well in 530 BJA 112, paragraph 24. But I think paragraphs 32 to 33 are more clear.
Go ahead.
So if you see in paragraph 32, the commission explains that it sets the numerical rate.
Tell me what the commission said.
Okay, the commission said.
I honestly don't have that JA in front of me right now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I would like to know.
I'm sorry, of course, Your Honor. I apologize. JA 116, paragraph 32, the commission says, quote, the commission has long required the use of DCF methodology to determine a zone of reasonableness with the lawful, just, and reasonable return on equity set at a single numerical point within that range based on the circumstances and record of that case. Therefore, when the commission finds a utility's base return on equity to be just and reasonable in a particular case, it finds only, and the commission emphasizes only, that's italicized, that single point to be just and reasonable given the facts and circumstances of the case. It doesn't find any other just and reasonable base ROE within the zone of reasonableness, either above or below, to be just and reasonable for that utility or group of utilities. Thus, and then it says... in that same paragraph, quote, it follows that showing the existing base return on equity established in the prior case is unjust and unreasonable merely requires showing that the commission's return on equity methodology now produces a numerical value below the existing numerical value.
Thank you.
And it goes on.
Yeah, you've given what I'm asking.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And so the commission's point is, in this circumstance, both steps happen at the same time. And again, there's nothing in the statute that says you must do step one before step two. That's certainly not an explicit holding. The commission gets to interpret
the statute.
The statutory
text is pretty close to saying that.
Well, the commission has interpreted it. I did look at that as well, of course, Your Honor. And
isn't your better position, rather than saying the statute doesn't require it, to say that you did it, you didn't leave out the first step. You simply...
That's right. Sure, that's exactly right.
Are you bound by prior judicial determinations that require two steps, like in Winfield and Papago?
In Winfield and Papago, the Winfield case was not a return on equity case, Your Honor, and Papago was, but, and if I can get to that in 1 second, and I want to get to that, but can I point out, yes, we are certainly bound, as is the petitioner, as petitioners are. And as I mentioned before, Public Service Company of New York said the commission's conclusion that only rates between 13.5% and 14.3% are just and reasonable supports it, excuse me, fulfills the requirement of Section 5, which is the same thing as Section 206 here, on both necessary findings. So that case shows that the commission can, in appropriate circumstances concerning ROE, can collapse. It's okay in the ROE context to make those findings through the same step, because that's how the commission determines what the just and, there's only one just and reasonable base ROE. So finding a new one means definitionally that the old one is no longer just and reasonable.
I thought in Papago they hadn't, the whole point was that they hadn't done it, and
sure,
and we figured out why it was okay.
Papago, I think that's true, and Your Honor, and the other point of Papago, which is not as clear from the opinion if you don't work at FERC and understand, at the time of Papago, FERC determined return on equity completely differently. It didn't use proxy companies. It it determined the base return on equity zone of reasonableness for a particular utility by using different analyses with the utility's own numbers. So there was no proxy done at the time. And so when the commission talked about the zone of reasonableness, when the commission talked about the zone of reasonableness in Papago, it really was a zone of reasonableness for that particular utility, because it was always using the utility's numbers. So when the court said finding that a particular ROE within that zone of reasonableness is no longer just and reasonable, when it sets a new ROE there, it didn't mean the other ones were no longer just and reasonable, because they really were potentially just and reasonable returns on equity for that particular utility. So it was done completely differently. Now the zone of reasonableness really doesn't mean the zone of reasonableness for the particular utility. It really just means in the industry.
But I'm curious about your argument that any time you calculate a new DCF and you get a new point that you pick on there, it necessarily means the other one was unjust and unreasonable. What if they were only off by a tenth of a percent?
I would imagine that there's a de minimis finding. That's certainly not the circumstance we have here, and I don't know of any case, but sure. I mean, if there's a...
Well, that's the rationale. The rationale, if we got one number, the other one must be unjust and unreasonable, and now you're saying, well, a tenth of a percent might not be, although a tenth of a percent can be an awful lot of money.
That's really just me pontificating. Mm-hmm. I'm sure based on the commission's precedent, there would be a new just and reasonable DCF.
So the old
ROE.
One was unjust and unreasonable.
The old one is unjust and unreasonable.
Even if it's off by a thousandth of a point. I mean, that's
yes.
The problem with
the
this,
answer is
this
yes.
Notion that just because we calculated a new number, the old one was necessarily wrong, because, again, the recognition of a zone of reasonableness, yeah. Not the DCF zone, but a zone of reasonableness suggests that there is at least some margin for judgment in there, so that you could actually have two numbers, that both of which could be determined to be just and reasonable.
Well, what the commission does in each case is look at the particular circumstances, so after it comes up with this zone, the DCF zone, it looks at the particular circumstances in a case, and that, I guess, would leave open for the de minimis.
Wouldn't your life be a whole lot easier right this minute if the commission had done the first step of the analysis explicitly and said this is unjust and unreasonable, therefore we can move to step two?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why didn't the commission go through the two steps here?
Because the point, as the commission explained, the way you find out whether the existing DCF ROE is just and reasonable, whether you the particular base ROE is unjust and unreasonable, is by determining the new just and reasonable. You do a new analysis.
There's no difference between 206 and 205 as far as the analysis is concerned?
There is. The difference is the commission then will make a finding the old one is unjust and unreasonable.
Did they make such a finding here?
The commission did. The commission found that it was, in paragraphs 32 and 33, the ALJ found it as well, that the prior... Sure, that finding is here in these orders. I don't think anybody disputes that.
And then the other difficulty here is that the commission calculates this DCF and then says, actually, we can't really rely on the DCF to have captured anomalous economic conditions, unspecified, although there's a reference to Treasury rates. There's no actual explication of what the anomalous economic conditions are.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the commission did explicitly rely. It is the Treasury bond.
I mentioned that. Well, but sure. Where did it explain why this methodology, which for years it has said captures information in the market and was using at the exact same time, the exact same year for the same time periods, in this case was not reliable because it didn't capture Treasury bonds? Did it in other cases capture Treasury bonds?
Let me first say, so I don't forget to say this, and I'll get right to that, Your Honor. The customers did not argue to the commission that that you can't rely on the upper portion of the DCF or any portion of the DCF because it's not reliable because of these anomalous concerns. They argued the exact opposite. They never made that argument. The concern you have, Your Honor, was not presented to the commission by the customers. They never argued you can't rely on it.
The rationale for the commission's decision to not use the midpoint was that the DCF was not reliable in this case. At JA-127,
right.
It was wrong.
And the customers said, commission's wrong about that. There's no anomalous concern here, and if there is, they said...
No, but I mean, if you take the commission at its word, then what on earth basis do they have for going, so let's just use the other end of that flawed set of numbers that we have, and let's just pick a different midpoint. Let's just pick a midpoint because we like midpoints.
And again, and it's important for purposes of the court's jurisdiction to address and to base their determination here on an argument that wasn't presented to the commission. No one argued to the commission, you can't, if you find that the DCF is not...
The commission has to have a reasoned analysis. No one has to say, by the way, you have to have a reasoned analysis. They have to have a reasoned analysis. And when they say the DCF is broken, so let's just do a different point on the DCF without any explanation as to how that was consistent or advanced the Bluefield Hope factors or why it was any less broken on that end than it was in the middle. That's a lack of reasoned decision-making, isn't it?
No, the commission's concern here only was that why it looked at these other analyses in the first place was that it was concerned that possibly the capital market conditions that were anomalous were not being incorporated into the DCF analysis for purposes of using the midpoint of the entire zone.
That was
the commission's concern.
And where do they explain, it may be or may not, I'm not an economics expert, but where do they explain why, given the nature of the design of the DCF and its longstanding assumption that it's incorporating market information, where do they explain why it couldn't be relied on this time in this case to have included those Treasury rates?
I think the commission really just had a concern, and that was based on just the notion which is in, which the commission talked about in opinion 531B at JA-127 paragraph 50, where it cited Morin for the proposition that all methods of estimating the cost of equity are susceptible to error when their underlying assumptions are anomalous. And so the commission said, and in Morin, which the commission cited at 28, talked specifically about the DCF. Even the DCF analysis is susceptible to being skewed by anomalies.
Sure. Where do they say which anomaly here and why Treasury rates wouldn't be part of the ordinary stock market information that they are already incorporating by using this collection of information from existing utilities?
The commission explained that it was... it talked about bond yields at 531 JA-70, note 285, and it talked
it's
about...
It's a long way away from this now. That's a different opinion, in fact, altogether.
Well, the two opinions go together, Your Honor.
But that's
sure.
An awful long way from explaining here that Treasury was the singular anomalous condition when they talked about plural conditions, and they can say all day it was anomalous, but that doesn't, why is it anomalous? Well, why wouldn't the information factored in just like you normally assume that the market is efficient and the numbers you collect are going to reflect all factors, including well, you know, Treasury is really low.
So I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is, again, what I was just talking about, how that record showed there and also concerning model risk, which was addressed at 531 JA 70 to 71, paragraph 145, note 286, and 531 JA 22, paragraph 41, the commission explained that, again, those things talk about how any model, including the DCF model, can be skewed. So the commission's concern, again, and the commission says this specifically at 531 JA 70, paragraph 145, and 531 BJ 126, paragraph 49, that the concern here was it had less confidence that the midpoint of the zone accurately reflected the equity necessary to meet Hope and Bluefield.
No, that's part of the problem. I mean, that's another one of the concerns I have, because in the rehearing decision, they say the DCF is the problem on 127, but in the initial decision, they said the midpoint is what we don't trust, a JA 70. So they weren't even consistent between the first decision and the rehearing decision as to what the problem was.
I'm sorry, where is that in the rehearing order, Your Honor?
So JA 70 said the midpoint skewed. Mm-hmm. And then 127, which is, I read it, and again, tell me if I'm wrong, it sounds like we don't trust the part you were just telling me, we don't trust the DCF, the DCF model can't be relied on when economic conditions are anomalous.
Well, the commission,
those are two different things.
The commission's only concern, the commission said it's every model has problems. The commission did say that, and I'm sorry, I don't have the paragraph cite for that. But the commission in these orders said every model has problems. Our preferred model remains the DCF analysis. It's still the best model. So when the commission had this concern that the midpoint might not satisfy the capital attraction standard of Bluefield and Hope, it said, you know what, we're going to just check. We're going to see. We're going to compare it to what state-authorized returns on equity are and these other expected earnings and capital asset and the risk premium. And it looked at all of those different things, and it saw that, wow, all of those things would provide a return on equity higher than the midpoint here, than 9.39. So all of the numbers were higher than the 9.39. Mm-hmm. Then the commission's next step was, okay, now we know that maybe our concern that the midpoint of the DCF isn't sufficient is corroborated by these analyses. Now we're stepping back and we're going to look at our precedent. What do we do when we have to increase above the midpoint of the entire zone? And the commission first said, well, we look at central tendency, and then it said, and we have these cases where our precedent shows that we use the midpoint of the upper half. Actually used the central tendency in the cases that the commission cited. It was a single utility, so they used the median. But here, you use the midpoint because this is a multi-utility return on equity.
Where did they say that doing that would take care of the anomalous conditions unspecified and would satisfy the Hope Bluefield factors? I saw that nowhere. I saw them say, we don't trust the midpoint. The DCF can't be relied on like it normally is here. So we like midpoints, let's pick a midpoint. That strikes me as the ultimate and arbitrary decision making. Had they said, and we think that will reflect the right information because it's in the vicinity of some of these other models, but they said, no, we're not looking at those other models for our picking our number, we just like midpoints.
Your Honor, and the commission's like of midpoints as showing as appropriately being inclusive of the bottom number and the top number and therefore encompassing all of the utilities that the return on equity will apply to, that's been affirmed by this court. I mean, the commission didn't come up and say, hey, let's just pick the midpoint. The commission,
I think that's
uses
what they said.
The midpoint.
I said we like midpoints, and so we're going with the midpoint.
The commission did that as well here. The commission just followed its precedent here. This isn't just out of the blue. The Commission in Consumers Energy had a circumstance where it knew it needed to go above the midpoint of the zone, and it applied the midpoint of the upper half of the zone, and it did as well.
Did it explain there because it didn't have the DCF itself didn't capture the relevant information, didn't capture that they were anomalous, and that was the only record information they had to go on?
No, that actually it wasn't. It wasn't the only record they have to go on. If you look at SoCal Ed 92 FERC 61070 at 61266, the commission had specific information. It said, given the conflicting evidence in the case on the issue of risk, we find that the updated financial data is the best quantifiable measure. So it was using updated financial data rather than the data that entities wanted them to use in the case. And so it had specific updated financial data, and then it determined at 61266-67 that the appropriate return on equity for SoCal Edison should be above the midpoint of returns indicated for the comparison group. Therefore, we will establish SoCal Ed's return on equity at the midpoint of the upper half of the zone of reasonableness. And it cited Consumers Energy. So in circumstances where the commission knows it needs to go above the zone in a since Consumers Energy, which was in 1998, the commission uses the midpoint of the upper half of the zone. Petitioners are not citing any case post-Consumers Energy which the commission did anything different. That's what the commission does. That's how it was consistent with its precedent, and it followed, and that precedent, using the midpoint, has been affirmed by this court.
In that case, specifically found that the DCF did not reflect market conditions.
No. Yes. Well, what it showed, what the concern there was that the DCF zone did not show.
Why would the top half, without further explanation, this could be explained. Why would the top half, the top quarter, reflect market conditions when the half does not?
I think that.
And in particular, the Hope Bluefield ones, which the commission doesn't make any effort to say is what that number will satisfy. I would have thought the companies would be saying it should be higher. That you can't just pick the midpoint. You have to explain that it satisfies Hope Bluefield. And, in fact, even that midpoint doesn't. We need higher.
This commission certainly addressed Hope and Bluefield, it mentioned all through these orders. So the commission had the Hope and Bluefield capital attraction standard.
You have to say the number you pick is satisfying those, and I didn't see it.
Sure, well, that's the whole purpose. The commission said Your Honor, I do disagree with that because the commission, the whole point in why it didn't rely just on the midpoint.
That's why it said the midpoint's no good. So then its job is to say what will meet Hope Bluefield.
Right.
And that requires an explanation as to how just picking this midpoint on the top half will satisfy Hope Bluefield. I don't know why the companies couldn't get up and say that midpoint wasn't high enough. In fact, our old rate was just unreasonable. And that's when they met Hope Bluefield, and you dropped the ball by not doing that.
I think Your Honor wants something more exacting in return on equity than you're going to get. It's based on proxy information. It's not like you know that if you order what the costs. There are certain costs that a utility has that are specific, like your cost of labor. So you know exactly how many employees you have and how much you pay them, and you know exactly what that is, and you can pick that exactly. This is a bit more amorphous than that. It's all based on proxy.
That's an argument against you, though.
Exactly.
No, I think in terms of the commission.
What do you do? You know, I notice in your brief you don't address Papago. You don't address City of Winfield.
Sure.
You don't address the
Sure, we do, Your Honor.
Calpine.
What?
I don't find it in your table of authorities.
City of Winfield. Our point is,
But let me read this to you, and you tell me. This is a FERC opinion from 2009, and it says, we note that the courts in this commission have recognized there's not a single just and reasonable rate. Instead, we evaluate tariff provisions to determine whether they fall into a zone of reasonableness. There's a range. Now, if that's true, and the commission still adheres to that, then the fact that the commission comes up with a number of 10.57 doesn't make the existing rate of 11.14 unjust and unreasonable. That wouldn't follow. So what do you do with language like that? And that's not the only FERC case.
There's myriad because those are not return on equity cases, Your Honor. Other than Papago, I've already explained, was a different circumstance. The zone of reasonableness.
I don't understand why that matters.
Because return on equity. The commission has determined, and the commission in its discretion does get to commit, it's a rate matter. The commission has determined that return on equity does not have a zone of reasonableness. It has a particular point that is just and reasonable. The commission has interpreted that the 206 protection.
You just said it's amorphous.
Yeah.
No. What I mean is the commission then has to use its judgment. I misspoke, and I didn't misspeak. What I missspoke. represented what I was trying to say. I just wasn't clear. My point is the commission is using a proxy circumstance where it then has to use its own judgment as to where to place it. And here the commission used its precedent. It followed its precedent, some of which is affirmed by this court, some of which just didn't come to court. And it followed its precedent. And there is not one case that petitioners are citing post-consumers that sets the return on equity at a different point than at the midpoint of the upper half. This is how the commission has been doing it for decades.
The 11.14, that came as a result of what?
That was their prior just and reasonable base return on equity based on the prior DCF zone of reasonableness. It was the midpoint of that
zone.
Was it
205 proceeding? Was there a proceeding?
It was. Yes, it was, Your Honor. Okay. Yes.
So the difference is that the 11.14 was set by the transmission owners, and the 10.57 is set by the commission. That's the difference. That's one difference.
Yes, that is true, but the point is, in both circumstances, the commission determined the just and reasonable return on equity. For example, in the prior case, in which Bangor Hydro, I believe, is where it was decided, the prior return on equity. In that case, if the petitioners had been trying to get the median rather than the midpoint, the commission would, just like happened in the SoCal Ed proceeding, this court affirmed the commission's determination that everything within that zone is not just and reasonable. The commission says that the midpoint is the just and reasonable point, not the median, or vice versa, depending on whether it's a one utility return on equity or a multi-utility return on equity.
So the commission did a DCF analysis in the 205 proceeding?
Of course.
And came up with a zone of reasonableness?
Came up with a zone of
and
industry.
What was that zone?
I don't have that information. The zone was 7.3 to 13.1, and the zone here was 7.03 to 11.74.
Mm-hmm. So how did the commission determine that the 11.14 was just and reasonable?
That was the midpoint of the 7.3 to 13.1 zone. There was no allegation here, just like there's been in no other proceeding before the commission recently. To address your concern, Your Honor, I believe, the first of all, the Seaway case is post this record, and the Brooklyn Union Gas case from this court indicates that it stands for the proposition that the court can't consider post-record up orders of the commission. We don't know what the commission will do on rehearing. You don't know what...
Well, I guess these treasury notes have been low for a very long time. They've been historically low for a very long time. So if DCF doesn't capture it, I'm shocked that you just keep using it.
This is the first time that the allegation has been raised, Your Honor.
Identified the problem. Shouldn't the commission on its own make sure it doesn't use it in other cases if it said it can't capture it?
If the commission doesn't consider that on its own in future cases, Your Honor, then that's something that if it comes before this court, this court can address that.
Or maybe the fact that the DCF was reliable the next month suggests that the explanation here is insufficient.
But that's not something that under Brooklyn Union Gas, Your Honor, that this court is allowed to consider. And then maybe frustrating, I'm sorry, but that is the court's precedent. And I think it makes sense because if the commission made a mistake, my point is the commission made a mistake in Seaway, not made a mistake in this case. And I'm not defending the Seaway orders here today.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. We've kept you up for a long time.
I appreciate it. There's nothing else the court wants me to address.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Okay, so I have your answer. But first, Your Honor, the NITOs did not set the 11.14. The commission set the 11.14 as a result of a litigated proceeding. The NITOs asked for more. So there is no difference in that respect, except that it was a 205 case instead of 206. Judge Millett, I would turn your attention to Joint Appendix page 72 and 73. Which are paragraphs 147 and 148 in opinion 531. The NITO's risk premium analysis was found to determine a cost of equity between 10.7 and 10.8%, which is above the 10.57. The CAPN analysis determined a range of 7.4 to 13.3 with a midpoint of 10.4 and a median of 10.9. And the expected earnings analysis, a range of 8.1 to 16.1 with a midpoint of 12.1.
Well, the state rose, so 89% of them were below 10.57, correct? On the state ROEs?
Going down.
89% were below 10.57?
I don't know about that, but recall that the midpoint was...
And then the median on expected earnings was 10.2. And the CAPM midpoint is 10.4.
But the midpoint...
That's not much supporting 10.57.
You know, all I'm trying to say is that there were a number of these that were much higher than the 10.57 and as high as 12.1. The point on the state ROEs is that the midpoint was 9.39. The states were at 9.8 to 10.74. And the commission found that transmission is a riskier business. Mm-hmm. How can we be below the very lowest state? Mm-hmm. And so the commission made a judgment to move it up in the range.
Do you even think that top midpoint was the right place for you to land?
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that it should be 11.14
right.
As a matter of law.
And there was no explanation for why they were picking that midpoint instead of your higher number? I mean, that's the thing with them collapsing the two steps here and then... Just picking that number and not explaining it, I'm just surprised you haven't complained more about that.
Maybe I'm not as good a lawyer as I should be, but
no, you're a very good lawyer.
Seriously, the commission had to exercise a judgment. I think the key point here is this is trying to infer a number. There is no one correct number. And that is one of the reasons that they're finding that only 10.57 is just and reasonable doesn't really make a lot of sense economically or financially as well as legally. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your Honor, there was discussion earlier of the possibility of a de minimis standard. This is not such a case. Every basis point here is worth more than $1 million out of ratepayers' pockets. So the commission really needed to articulate some basis for why it adjusted the return upwards by 118 basis points from the midpoint to the top quarter. And the idea that we just do midpoints doesn't cut it. Footnote 306 of opinion 531 is really pivotal. That's where the commission laid out guidance to future cases. And it said, we will consider every point in the range. And it cited precedent where the court had said that it can't be confined just to 2 points.
Sorry, is that in the JA? I just don't have that one.
Yes, it is. It's in the underlying orders. It's footnote 306 of opinion 531.
What JA page are you on? Sorry.
I don't have that at my fingertips.
All right. I'll look at it later. It's okay.
And the commission also cited that Consumers Energy, that came up in the earlier questioning. The key point about Consumers Energy is that the way the commission did the DCF there is it averaged across the dividend yields of all the proxy companies and averaged across the growth rates for all the proxy companies. So it came up with a single DCF result. It didn't have an array of 38 data points as we have here, the array that the commission has said provided them with robust information about the New England transmission owners.
Well, they say we've done midpoint before. When we found problems with the DCF before, we've just picked the upper midpoint in the past too.
They've landed at a wide variety of places in the range, only in circumstances, however, where it's not that they distrusted the DCF. They distrusted that the DCF was measuring the cost of capital for the particular company at issue or for the right period.
Mm-hmm.
So they. Before this court's Southern California Edison decision in 2013, they would adjust based on treasury yield trends between the DCF study period and the time that the rate was being set for. That's why you had that 74 basis point difference in setting the 11.14. The DCF finding in that case actually was 10.4.
Mm-hmm.
So they've gone up from that finding,
mm-hmm.
strangely. The other basis, the most common basis on which they would adjust within the range was because of a finding that the proxy group was measuring a set of companies with a different risk than the utility at issue. And they sort of gestured toward that explanation here in opinion 531. They said, we can adjust when there's a different risk. But they backed off that in opinion 531B. They said that, no, actually, this proxy group is risk representative. There's no dispute about that. And therefore, the precedent in Consumers Energy and Southern California Edison for varying from the midpoint simply doesn't apply because we have a representative number here.
Another question? Thank you very much. The case is submitted.
Thank you.